It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, we'll break down today's economic news about jobs and the stock exchange.
First, the heroin and opiate epidemic in Wisconsin is getting a lot of attention, and now one healthcare group is trying to address that problem. Citizen Action of Wisconsin is launching a campaign targeting young Wisconsinites for addiction screenings and interventions.
Robert Craig is here with us to talk about it. He's the executive director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
So what are you doing in this new program?
Well, as with anything in medicine, if you can prevent something or catch it early, it's a lot cheaper to treat, and it leads to a lot better results. So if you can avoid addictions, heroin and opiate addictions in the first place, or catch them very early, it's much better for the young person, and it saves a lot of money down the line. And so what we're launching in Wisconsin, there have been a lot of consumer activists, healthcare advocates that have been working on this, and there have been medical doctors that developed a model where you clearly have screening and brief intervention whenever the first indications arise for young people in their mid to late teens and early 20s. And if you can set it up so the schools are involved, parents are involved, it's clear to doctors and all the major healthcare systems, and very importantly that insurance will cover it, then you can catch things very early and prevent them from spinning out of control and make sure that when there is a serious situation, there's an assessment and there's an immediate referral to treatment. And so it's called screening and brief intervention and referral to treatment. So it's a little bit of a mouthful, but the idea is to prevent addictions before they really get started or early on, and then get people into appropriate treatment whenever necessary.
So are we screening kids for signs that they might be in a risk group, or that they've, you know, been in contact with people who have access to heroin and other opioids, or they've tried it for the first time? Where are we trying to intervene here?
It's just a whole list of different indicators that substance abuse may have begun. And at that point, if teachers and school health officials know, parents know, then there's a screening. And once you're a screening, you determine whether there needs to be a brief intervention and a referral to treatment, or maybe the screening will determine there's no problem there. And then for how serious the intervention and treatment is depends on how serious the problem is. And so it needs to be a clear model where everyone knows what to do. The problem is that there are all these different approaches out there. There's not good information. Parents don't know. And then there's a real problem with whether insurance is going to cover it or not. The state's Badger Care program, Medicaid, has covered this since 2008, which is not always well known, but the insurance companies are all over the map, and it may be very hard for parents or school officials to figure it out in which time a situation is spiraling out of control. So it really is looking at early indicators and getting every kid who seems to be at risk, who might be having a problem, young adults and teenagers, to a screening. And so then you go from there based on how the screening turns out.
And is anything like this being done in Wisconsin schools or doctors' offices already?
Yes, there are a number of schools participating in this already. There are a number of medical professionals. In fact, the model was developed in Madison by medical professionals. What's lacking is where it's clear and uniform, so that every school official, parents know what to do. And so the problem is that a lot of times, and this happens later in addiction as well, there just isn't clear enough protocol as to what to do and what the next step should be, or clarity in it being paid for. Obviously, it's very important to a family that their insurance cover it. Otherwise, treatment can get very expensive, as you know. So it's not. There's a lot of very good experimentation that's gone on. We're at the point, because Wisconsin's one of five states that are part of this project, where it just needs to be very systematic, and there needs to be a lot of advocacy to make sure that every entity in the supply chain, doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, schools, and parents are on the same page and it's clear what to do.
You mentioned Wisconsin's one of five states being supported by national groups in doing this. Why Wisconsin?
Partly because there's been a lot of innovation here. In fact, a doctor in Madison is one of the major, Dr. Richard Brown is one of the major leaders in developing this whole medical model. There are a number of advocacy groups that have already been involved in promoting this model. In addition, as a lot of your listeners know, Wisconsin has a tradition of being very innovative on healthcare coverage and in terms of healthcare delivery. And so it's considered by national people a good place to develop this model. But the idea is to establish this clearly in Wisconsin and the other early adopter states, and then make it a national model for the whole country.
Is this still something that you need to try it, pilot it in a few states, and really see if it works? Do we have enough track record to know this is going to work, or are we still in the research stages here?
we know it works from the standpoint that if the model is implemented, that it works quite well, that it leads to good decisions about screening, good decisions about what kind of treatment might be needed, and also, you know, obviously being covered by insurance. The issue is simply that not enough people know what to do, and different schools, different doctors, different hospitals, different insurance companies are all over the map. So it's we're to the point where it needs to be systematized, where there's really good public education, where there is good advocacy to make sure that all the different key players are on the same page. And this is the problem with our healthcare system, as you know, Rob, lack of alignment. The doctors and the hospitals, the insurance companies, the schools have to all be on the same page to make this work. So that's what this experiment is, to create a working system so that every kid who shows signs of early substance abuse or being at risk for it gets a screening, and then we go from there. That would greatly reduce the impact. Once you have a serious addiction, which is something we have to work on as well, it becomes much more difficult. It's like allowing more cancers to occur where we could prevent them early on in the early stages.
Once this trial period is done, you said getting the insurance companies all in line on this, would it take a state mandate, a legislative mandate, to require insurance companies to provide care for this kind of screening and subsequent treatment?
That's a really good question. We're not absolutely sure. We actually think that it may well be possible because it saves the insurance companies money, and because new federal rules are coming in on mental health parity, that it may be possible to do this simply through organizing and advocacy and working with the insurance companies. But if a lot of them still won't do it, then it might well require state legislation or at least rulemaking. But at this point, we're hopeful that it would not, that this could be done simply through working with doctors, hospitals, and the insurance companies directly and showing the benefits of this to them.
There's been a lot of legislation we've talked about on this show this year related to heroin addiction. A lot of it is keeping prescription opioids out of the hands of people who could abuse them. A lot of it is on treating people who are already addicted. Are you trying to fill a gap between those two points here?
Yes. Obviously, they have to be related. I mean, just as I said, we need alignment as to how we deal with all of these early cases where there might be a sign that a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old kid may be having a problem. That has to be aligned with efforts to prevent prescription opiates from getting into people's hands, because that's the gateway, and then heroin is cheaper, so that's what leads people to go to heroin. And also, you need a much better system for treatment for people who are already addicted, which is also a major problem. So those need to be aligned as well. But the niche we're looking at here, which is the one that could actually prevent the most cases, is having a screening of all kids, that young adults and teenagers that show any kind of the signs that they may be becoming addicted to a substance, to an opiate, then a brief intervention, depending on how the screening turns out, and then a referral to treatment. And then, of course, once they're referred to treatment, we need to make sure that the treatment is paid for, that families can get health insurance coverage for it or Medicaid coverage, depending on the family.
Do you see this model of this widespread screening and then treatment as needed, something you could export beyond opioids and heroin to other elements of health?
Absolutely. This is the way healthcare needs to go in the United States. We have a very high quality system in terms of specialty care. We don't do nearly as good job as we need to with prevention and management of diseases. And so this is exactly the kind of...
I think we've lost Robert Craig there. Robert?
Oh. I'm still here.
Okay. So you were wrapping up the idea of exporting this screening and prevention to other areas of health.
Yeah, I just think it's exactly the way healthcare needs to go in this country if we're going to increase the quality of healthcare and control its cost. That prevention is much cheaper than treating a problem once it's very serious. And so if we're going to have an affordable healthcare system and a high-quality healthcare system, this is exactly the kind of reform we need to undertake across the whole healthcare system. That's how we see it. We see this as the opening of much broader reforms in the way we deliver healthcare, both in Wisconsin and the United States.
Robert, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Robert Craig. He's Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. There's plenty of economic news to sort through today. First off, the Labor Department announced that employers added 288,000 jobs in the month of June, unemployment falling to 6.1%.
That was good news not only for workers, but for investors as well. For the first time ever, the Dow Jones Industrial Average topped 17,000 points, continuing its steady growth over the last year. At the same time, President Obama recently told NPR's Marketplace that he's still seeing Wall Street and big banks take too many big risks. And for For his administration, banking reform is an unfinished piece of business.
Here with us to talk about all the latest economic news and what it means for us is Chris Farrell. He's senior economics contributor for Marketplace Money. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, lots of data points to tackle today. Let's start with this job report. Billed as good news by many. 288,000 jobs added, better than expected. What accounts for that jump?
Well, here's the thing about this job report. This is the first job report I can remember in a long time where the response and the reaction was across the board positive, because the when you looked at the numbers, it was, you know, our economy, in terms of the job market, was firing on all cylinders across the board. And even the government sector, which has been a real drag on the job market, was showing some improvement. So I think this was overall what was striking about it is that it was across the board. And the drop in the unemployment rate, you know, you recall that we've had these drops in the unemployment rate, but it's because, you know, people are dropping out of the labor market and they've given up. They're not going to get a job. And this time we got a job in the unemployment rate for the right reason. People were getting hired.
So that labor participation rate, we're not seeing as many people giving up on the job market, maybe even seeing some come back in?
Well, in terms of labor participation rate, this is why I think everybody has to sort of be positive about this. This is a sign that the economy is getting healthier, the job market is getting healthier, but you raise the important issue. There's still a lot of people on the sidelines, very little movement in the labor force participation rate. And so there are many people, there were over 7 million people who are in part-time jobs that would like to be in full-time jobs. And then you have many people that have given up and they are on the sidelines. So again, this is a good report. It's going in the right direction, but the damage to the economy and the labor market has been so deep that we still have a long ways to go before we can get euphoric about the labor market.
Are there sectors that are doing particularly well where the jobs are really at right now?
So there's a lot of hiring in business services. One of the areas that was striking is this was a good report in terms of the manufacturing labor market, the factory sector, where we saw some nice increases in the government sector, which, you know, the private sector economy, if you look at the numbers and you remove the government, private sector economy has actually been doing pretty well. It's been held back in terms of the job market by a lot of cutbacks by state and local governments in particular. And in this one, what we saw was a lot of hiring of teachers. And that's a sector that really needs to be rebuilt. And I think we're going to start seeing many more positive numbers coming out of the state and local government sector because, tax receipts are up. There's a lot of construction spending, a lot of infrastructure spending that's going on around the states. So we should see some improvement there, too.
In general, stepping away from this particular report, are these monthly job reports a good reflection of the economy's overall health?
Well, you know, when we talk about the economy, you know, we can talk about GDP or what's happening in the capital equipment investment. But, you know, when it comes down to the economy, what really matters to most people is what's the job market doing? So the job market is still disappointing. We're the last couple of months, we're averaging about 270,000 plus. So we're going the right direction. The recent numbers have been revised upward. This is all good. But we want this to be a much higher number in order to really reach down and get the long-term unemployed and really start reducing those numbers dramatically.
And are we seeing a lot of people still in that long-term unemployed category, which would mean, I guess, they're still in the job market, they still are looking for work, still haven't found work?
Yes. So the long-term unemployed, just so that's you're unemployed for 27 weeks or longer. And in this report, we saw a drop in the long-term unemployed. So it was a sign. This is one of the most optimistic signs out there. Suggests employers are starting to reach down further into the job market to do their hiring. But it's still the long-term unemployed is still double its long-term average. So we still got a long ways to go there.
That's a problem.
So
as jobs grow, not as fast as many would like, are wages going up with them?
Wages are going up, but they're going up at like a 2% rate. And this is one of the things I'd put a caution out there. when I was reading some of the commentary, listening to some of the commentary coming particularly out of Wall Street, they're saying, you know, this is an incredible, you know, and we've got to start thinking about a tight labor market. We've got to start thinking about inflation is going to be coming pretty soon. But you look at the wages, you know, the wages are not moving. They're up 2%, so pretty much matching the rate of inflation. And so we're not seeing any signs of wage inflation, which means there's still slack in there. And by the way, as the long-term unemployed come out of the ranks of the long-term unemployed and join the ranks of the employed, which is wonderful, they're typically more willing to accept any wage that they're offered. So that's also going to put some downward pressure on wages. So I think that's what we should be watching over the next year. And boy, I hope we see some real wage increases, but I think it's going to take time.
When we see a positive number like this, politically often somebody wants to take credit for it. Does somebody deserve credit for a couple good months of job numbers, or is it just sort of an economic recovery?
You know, it's an economic recovery. We're in the fifth year. I'm in the camp that thinks we should have been doing a lot more on the infrastructure spending side. I mean, why wouldn't you want to when interest rates are essentially zero? And why wouldn't you want to do more in terms of repairing your roads and your airports and mass transit and all kinds of things? But I think this is, you know, the state and local governments are cutting back less. And so that is really helping out. And it's just the sort of unfolding of more economic activity, more people being employed, spending a little more money. You're seeing the auto market, for example. You know, there's been a lot of pent-up demand in the auto market, and that's where we can really see it. I expect we're going to see some pent-up demand in the housing market. So people are repairing their homes. They delayed a lot of purchases, and it feeds on itself.
Well, something that fed on these job numbers today, apparently the Dow surpassing 17,000 points for the first time ever this morning. Did the one drive the other?
Yes. It's really a remarkable. I mean, if you think about it, 64 months of a strong market. Think back to the dark days of 2009. The Standard & Poor's 500 is, what, up three times since then. You know, this is one of the longest bull markets on record, at least in American record. So it's quite something. And, yes, it was you know, if it's increasing signs that the U.S. economy is continuing to repair, as more people have jobs and they have more income and they're going to go out and they're going to be more willing to spend a little more. And so that's just feeding into increasing optimism about the outlook for the economy. You have Europe, Central Bank has decided to keep its interest rates really low. And so we have a sense that, you know, this global recovery is very slow, but kind of everyone's going in the same direction. We're actually one of the strongest in the world, but everyone's kind of going in the same direction. So again, that's going to help support our export market, support some trade. So that's all feeding into the stronger stock market.
Is this rational exuberance here or irrational?
Well, I think that it is rational exuberance. So one of the big debates that's going on is the stock market just reflect a sugar high? I mean, this is just the Federal Reserve. They've driven interest rates down. They've swollen their balance sheet. You know, they've flooded the system. And this is not real. And this is just another bubble that's going to burst. And I'm in the camp that doesn't agree with that. I think if you look at corporate profits have been strong. I mean, and they were down recently, but up until very recently, corporate has been very strong. Corporate cash flow has been very strong. You know, mergers and acquisitions are picking up. And to a large extent, if you think about the Dow in particular, that's 30 giant companies, and the S&P 500, which is 500 large companies, you know, they're no longer tied to the U.S. economy. They're tied to the global economy. And so corporate profits have been strong. Corporate earnings have been strong. And I think that's largely reflected in the stock market.
A lot of people are sort of indirectly invested in the stock market through things like 401ks, IRAs. Should these record numbers make people feel more secure about their retirement futures?
Well, at least we're no longer talking about 201ks and 101ks. We are talking about 401ks again. I do think for anybody who went through and has a 401k or some sort of retirement savings plan, and you went through 2008, 2009. I'm not predicting that we're going to go back to a period like that, but how did you feel? You know, don't get greedy. You know, take some gains if you think you're going to get nervous or if you want to ride it out. But it really has repaired or helped repair the retirement savings in the country. And so for individuals, I think this is wonderful who are able to save. And then I think they just need to be looking at, you know, the trees don't grow to the sky. The Dow isn't going to go to 17, 18, 19, 20,000 without some scary moments along the way. So you just have to be very conscious of where you are in your life cycle, what is your risk tolerance, all that kind of thing, and make sure that you're making judgments based on your lifestyle, not on what some forecaster is saying.
We're talking with Marketplace Money's Chris Farrell about today's economic news, a jobs report, the Dow over 17,000. Coming up, a look at GDP numbers and President Obama and the banks. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
And what do you make of today's economic news? Are you seeing economic improvement in your part of the state, in your life? Maybe you just started a new job or you're currently looking for one. Tell us about your experience at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. That's 800-642-1234.
We're talking about today's economic news with Chris Farrell. He is senior economics contributor for Marketplace Money. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. A positive jobs report, a surging Dow. Do you think the economy is on the right path? Are you seeing economic improvement where you live? And just have a basic question about what all these economic tea leaves mean anyway. Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Chris, a pretty positive jobs report, the Dow breaking another record. So, of course, our last report on the GDP, the gross domestic product, was a significant drop.
Yeah.
What happened there?
That was the GDP fell what almost 3% at an annual rate, and to a large extent, it was that winter that we all lived through and we all suffered, and it just had nationwide effects. And that isn't the complete story, but sort of in the mind of the forecasters, that's the story. It was the winter. The winter had an enormous dampening effect on the economy. And right now, it's a really safe bet that many of your economists are increasing their forecast going forward. Say they were thinking, well, we're going to be growing at a 3% annual rate. They may be saying 3.1, 3.2 after this job number. So the bad report is being attributed to the bad winter. And this labor market report, plus the ones that came in the months before, is driving a lot of economists to increase their forecast for the future.
Just to get to the basics here, what goes into the calculating the gross domestic product, or in public radio terms, what is a GDP?
So GDP is the all your goods. It's adding up all your goods and services in the economy. And so it's our broadest measure of all the activity that we have. And, of course, it's a snapshot. And it doesn't capture a lot of the intangibles. I mean, if you think about a company like Facebook, you know, billions and billions of dollars that it's worth. Now, if you start adding up Facebook in terms of its buildings, is it, what, 4,000 employees, 5,000 employees, and the buildings that it has, it doesn't come anywhere near close to its valuation. It's all the ideas, and it's that's how they define the intangibles, and the GDP does not capture that. But it tries to capture all the goods, the services, the trade that goes on within our borders.
And is this, I keep asking you this with the jobs and the Dow, now is the GDP a good sign to a good indicator of the performance of the economy?
Well, the thing about the GDP is, you know, to one extent, it's looking back, right? So you had, you know, the nearly 3% decline in the economy from the first quarter. So that's looking back. So how much does that tell us about what's going on? So that's why we're looking at the labor market. What's happening with capital spending? What's happening to corporate profits? What's the stock market telling us is going to be going on? What are interest rates telling us what might be going on? So we're, you know, always trying to look at these other indicators. What the GDP does and what it is important is it tells us, you know, are businesses building up inventories? Are inventories going down? What's been the performance of our exports and our exports economy? So it gives us a report card, and there's really valuable information in that report card, but it also is a snapshot that captures a past moment.
Now, President Obama talked to Marketplace earlier this week, and he highlighted what he said was some good news about the economy, but a worry about Wall Street and Wall Street banks taking big risks. He said reforming that is, quote, an unfinished piece of business for his administration. What kind of risks, what kind of behavior is he talking about?
So one of the things he's talking about is the incentives to take a big bet. So you're a trader. You're on Wall Street. And you, to a large extent, you're actually not paid that much. I mean, you're paid well relative to most people, but you're not really paid that much on a salary basis. It's what's going to be your bonus. And so as you, you know, become a trader and you begin to learn the ropes and you take $1 million bet, okay, you know, $1 million bet, you make some money. But what if you made it a $10 million bet? You'd even make more money. And so that's part of what he's talking about. And you, and with the hedge funds and all the, you know, some of the private equity and all these incentives to be taking very large bets, that is still going on. And it's somewhat controlled right now because the memory of 2008, 2009, it's still incredibly powerful. But how confident can we be in 5 years? So let's say we keep growing. Unemployment gets better. People get happier. And the economy has a little bit of exuberance. You know, at that point, are we really confident that we have in place the kind of safety nets that will prevent a reprise of what just recently happened? And I think what he's saying is, you know, we've got some things are better. We have some better safety nets, but the incentives are still on Wall Street or the financial services industry broadly defined. It's heads I win, tails the taxpayer loses.
Right. That's the whole too big to fail argument. If these companies know that they're too big and important for the federal government to let them collapse and risk a massive depression, they, there's a moral hazard. They may take risks knowing that net is there for them.
And it's, and, you know, and that is part of, you know, that's what Wall Street does. And in a global economy with the derivatives, you know, some of the derivatives, which are, you know, securities on top of securities, securities that are packaged or traded around the world, you know, some of that is actually improved. I mean, they're on open exchanges. People have a better sense of what's going on with the derivatives market. But a lot of these derivatives are hidden. They're in the shadows. And it's uncertain where the risk really is. So I think he's actually right to sound a warning, and there's some deep flaws with the Dodd-Frank bill. I mean, it's a lot of rules, it's a lot of regulations, and over time, you hire very smart people who figure out how to get around those rules and those regulations.
Any indication of reforms that the president's hoping, either through executive order or somehow to get through Congress?
Well, I think there it's mostly up to, you know, one of the things that we're watching, I think it's up to a lot of the agencies, and that's where the activity is shifting to. So the Securities and Exchange Commission, which for, you know, for a long time, Securities and Exchange Commission, sadly, has been almost a non-agency. If you think about the rescue, I mean, it was the Federal Reserve was in there, the FDIC was in there, and where's the Securities and Exchange Commission? They weren't even invited to the table many times. Now, under the new head with Mary Jo White, she's much more aggressive. She's taking a stronger stand. So I think a lot of this stuff is coming out through the Securities and Exchange Commission. I think the Federal Reserve, they're wrestling with a big issue, which is, you know, there's no point for them to be raising interest rates now, but that point will come at some point. But, you know, raising interest rates is really a blunt instrument. Do you want to raise interest rates, or do you want to tell mortgage lenders you have to be more conscious of the quality of what you're doing rather than raise interest rates on everyone? So I think a lot of it is happening at the agency level, and what Obama is basically saying is keep up the pressure.
I'll take a call now. We've got Steve on the line in Stoughton. Steve, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Well, all this great economic news, the stock market at high points and unemployment doing well. I thought Obamacare was going to crush our economy. What am I missing here?
Steve, thanks for the call. There has been an ongoing debate over the economic impact of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Is there any kind of economic verdict yet on this, Chris?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of heated rhetoric. But, you know, I think if you basically look at it, the Affordable Care Act is working and it's coming closer to, you know, what the idea was. More and more people are signing up. You're starting to, you know, businesses are starting to figure it out. For many companies, it's actually, in the end, for many companies, it actually wasn't much of a change. So I'm on the skeptic that the Affordable Care Act was a dead weight on this economy. In many respects, it may liberate aspects of the economy. Many people may feel much more comfortable trying and going out and start their own business. You know, I think that there's going to be an entrepreneurial surge on the supply side of our economy because of the Affordable Care Act, because we're going to have a real individual health insurance market for the first time, which is something we really haven't had. So, yes, the Affordable Care Act is having some effect on the economy, but I don't see it as a major factor, at least not relative to the political rhetoric.
Chris, before I let you go, the next data point you're watching for?
Well, we're still going to be watching in terms of the labor market, and I also really want to watch on capital spending. What's happening with capital spending as companies, are they going to start really investing more? What are they going to do with this cash? I mean, they have these huge amounts of cash. They're starting to hire more. Are they going to start spending more in plant and equipment and expansion? So watch capital spending and watch what happens in the job market. And just remember that there's still a lot of slack. There's still too many unemployed. There's still too many factories that aren't running at full runs. So we still have a ways to go, but at least we're heading the right direction.
Chris, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Chris Farrell. He's senior economics contributor for Marketplace Money.
Coming up, we ask you to share your real-life hero. Who's your hero, why, and what makes a hero? You can call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
Today, we're sandwiched between two historic dates, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act and Independence Day.
Some of the people behind those two events are viewed as heroes of American history. And in today's edition of Share Something, we're following that theme of heroism. And we want to hear from you. Who is your real-life hero? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Maybe friends, family, famous historical people, you name it. Call 800-642-1234. As you call in now, we'll take a moment to pick someone who might not be on your list, maybe a TV anti-hero. 25 years ago this week, a so-called TV show about nothing hit the airwaves, and television comedy would never be quite the same again. Let's take a listen to two of the program's characters discussing their show within a show.
You want to go with me to NBC?
Yeah, I think we really got something in.
What do we got?
An idea.
What idea?
An idea for the show.
I still don't know what the idea is.
It's about nothing.
Right.
Everybody's doing something. We'll do nothing.
So we go into NBC, we tell them we got an idea for a show about nothing.
Exactly.
They say, what's your show about? I say, nothing.
There you go.
I think you may have something here.
That's Jerry Seinfeld and George Costanza, two of the main characters from the legendary sitcom Seinfeld, which celebrates its 25th birthday this week. From Festivus pulls to Man Hands and everything in between, Seinfeld created a seemingly endless supply of one-liners and cultural references that fans still love to talk about till this day.
You can post your favorite Seinfeld episode or moment on the Central Time Facebook page. And now we're ready to take your calls. We're asking you to share your real-life hero, past or present, living or dead. You can go anywhere you want with this. Famous world figure, a local hero in your community, maybe a family member. Tell us about your hero, someone who influences you, inspires you, and what you think makes someone a hero. What is heroic behavior? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our first caller now. We've got Bill on the line from New Berlin. Hey, Bill.
Hi.
Who's your hero?
I have three heroes. The first is my daughter, Pamela, because she's an absolute angel on earth. She reaches out to everybody constantly. She's got 20 music students. She buys them all presents every month. She sends hundreds of thank you notes. But she's just an angel. Hmm. My second hero is Jackie Gleason, because he only had an eighth grade education, and yet he wrote a book Gigo, and he made a movie of it called Gigo, and he wrote the musical score, and he conducted the orchestra. Mm. He starred in the movie. He never speaks a word because he plays the part of a mute.
Mm.
And yet, I've seen that movie 29 times, and I cry, and I laugh every time. It's a fabulous movie. Came out in 1960. And my 30-year-old is Judas, because he's been so misrepresented throughout history in tales from supposedly from the Bible. But if you read the book of Judas, you'll see that Jesus took Judas aside in the middle of the Last Supper, took him outside and said, I want you to turn me in. And Judas said, I can't do that because they'll kill you. And Jesus explained that he had to die on the cross to fulfill prophecy.
All right, so three very different heroes there. Wow, that's a huge range. Your daughter, Jackie Gleason, some stories I had never heard about Jackie Gleason. Thank you so much for sharing those, Bill. And at the end there, Judas, thank you for sharing those. Appreciate that.
You can join in with your hero at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Molly with us in Milwaukee. Molly, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I would like to say my hero is actually a young woman named Malala Yousafzai.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure most people have heard of her. She was the activist who was 14 years old when she was shot by the Taliban. She was campaigning for women's and girls' education, and she survived that, as she survived multiple attacks on her person and her personality and her work. And to this day, she's younger than I am by several years, and she has already accomplished so much for women's rights and girls' rights in areas where we need that the most. So I hope one day to achieve just a tenth of what she has achieved.
Molly, it sounds like, in addition to admiring what she's done, she inspires you?
Absolutely. Oh, like to have, again, just a fraction of the impact that she has had on human rights would be an absolute dream.
And she also inspired the singer Sarah McLachlan. I just read yesterday that there's a song on Sarah McLachlan's new album that is about Malala as well. So she's really spreading out and influencing, inspiring a lot of people. So thank you for that call. And if you want to join us, 800-642-1234, excuse me, we're asking about who your favorite hero is. Who is someone who's inspired you in real life, a family member, a friend, someone from history? 800-642-1234.
A couple lines open up if you got a busy signal a minute ago. 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Steele with us in Appleton. Hey, Steele, who you got?
Yes, I have Elon Musk, the president of Tesla Motors, and he took down all his patents. And and I'm just quoting it, the innovative CEO wants to allow other electric vehicle manufacturers to use his technology to advance sustainable mobility worldwide.
And do you think he's somebody other people in the corporate world should follow his example and open up some patents?
I think so. And also in the article, they were wondering, well, who's going to steal it and then put a patent on it? So, yeah, we shouldn't be hiding behind the big walls anymore.
Gotcha. Steele, thanks for sharing your hero. I've got more callers coming in now at 800-642-1234. You and I talked a little bit about this. Did you come up with some heroes to share, Veronica?
Well,
it was a tough one for me.
It was an interesting one to think about. There's certainly lots of candidates. I find Nelson Mandela inspiring, especially this year, the year of his passing. Mm-hmm. We talked about his, you know, his insistent positivity in the face of so much suffering that he went through. I find him an inspiring figure. And of course, my family. I think a lot of people feel like that. I'm very inspired by my family.
Well, I hate to be so unoriginal. I thought about my parents and grandparents. I think I could see anything good in me came from them, and
yeah,
anything bad in me I came up with on my own mostly. And Nelson Mandela, and one of the things I admire, George Washington along a similar line, is that they came into power, and when they were done, they left. And in so many countries where you have this big transition, the problems start when the first person in the new order doesn't want to leave. Mm-hmm. And that's when the wars start and the civil wars start. And I think that was one of the defining moments of his career, when he left power.
Very timely offering for the 4th of July, George Washington.
And I'll throw in paramedics, too, because I can't imagine doing their job. They save people's lives. I can't envision being in that kind of situation and performing and not just losing my mind.
Yeah, that's a great one. Well, let's see what Claire has to say. Claire joins us next in Mequon. Hi, Claire.
Hi.
What is your vote for a, who is your vote for a hero?
My hero is my brother, Josh Shimoleski. He is an active duty Marine stationed in Miramar, California.
Ah, so this is a your dedication to him. What does he do that inspires you as a Marine and a brother?
I've looked up to him for as long as I can remember. No matter what he was doing, I've always wanted to be exactly like him. So now that he's a Marine, I look up to him even more because he's doing everything he can to protect his country.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for calling and sharing that with us and thinking of your brother as we head into the 4th of July holiday.
Thanks a lot, Clara. We'll go now to Alex with us in Green Bay. Alex, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Who did you want to share as a hero?
First off, my mom. She's just like a super intelligent woman and inspires me every day. And all the moms in my life who have been strong and supportive and set up a way for me to view women as mentors. And now that I'm a little bit older, I have two really awesome professors who mentor me, Katya Leventova and Dr. Bartel, just wonderful women who inspire me every time I get a chance to talk to them.
Alex, thank you so much for sharing those. A few people have made a big difference in Alex's lives.
And we go next to Ryan. Ryan's in Wausau. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. My hero is Terry Fox. He was a 17-year-old in Canada who got leg cancer and lost his leg. So he decided to raise money and awareness for cancer. So he attempted to run across Canada with one leg. And, like, he would run a marathon in the morning and a marathon at night every single day.
Wow, that's incredible.
Trying to reach his goal.
And did he?
He ended up getting lung cancer in Thunder Bay, Canada, like halfway, and he didn't make it. He ended up dying like a year later.
I'm sorry to hear
that. Pretty amazing story.
Yeah, that is an amazing story. Despite the ending, which we wish had been different, it's amazing when you see people really trying to make a difference and putting 100% of themselves into what they care about. So thank you so much for that, Ryan.
And John is with us now in Washburn. John, hi.
Hi. My personal hero is Matthew Shepard. When he died after his beating, I came out because I couldn't let his death be in vain like that.
Wow, John, thank you so much for sharing that. Somebody who made a huge difference in a life decision that you made. Well, thanks for all your calls. You can keep the conversation going and still share your hero. We've got a post over at the Central Time Facebook page.